my dick out of the corner of your eye if you have to, but pretend you're watching the flick. So, you know, we were buddies for a long time, and I had a lot of respect for you.
You loved me.
Had a lot of respect for you, and now I... Well, you know we had some good times together, and I...
You're lonely and you miss me.
Let's just say everybody needs friends. Hey, I love my girlfriend, but she's pregnant now, you know. Oh, I guess you didn't know.
Bruce spit on his hand and stroked the length of his cock. Alan's own cock was hard now. He couldn't help himself.
He watched Bruce's cock out of the corner of his eye. He tried to block out the picture of the woman on the TV screen. He began stroking his own cock. Anyway, so I watched the videos for the time being.
Because you're afraid that if you fuck your girlfriend, you'll dent the baby's little head. Straight men always think that.
They do? Well, it does seem to me that my cock is even bigger than it was. I measured it, and it's not. But my cock just seems huge now. I guess that's part of getting to be straight Bruce. Anyway, I'm real drunk or this wouldn't be happening. I'm real drunk and horny. So look, why don't you just suck my dick a little while I watch the video?
Bruce!
Come on, Alan, you've done it before. I don't get much head these days.
Bruce, you know the doctor said it was catching.
He wasn't sure. And they don't know everything. You know you want it. Come on. Please. I may not be this drunk again.
Alan stopped pulling on his cock. His erection was beginning to wilt. I get it now. You want me to catch it. You want me to be just like you.
It won't be so bad. Come on. You'd love to have my dick again. Look, my girlfriend has a sister. It won't really be so bad, like we can go fishing together. I'll show you how to work on cars. Maybe when the girls go to see their mother, maybe we could get drunk together, maybe real drunk. Maybe things would be like old times.
Alan's eyes widened with horror.
No, it wouldn't be like old times. You want me to be just like you.
Bruce hadn't stopped jerking on his cock. When the tip poked out of the foreskin, it was very red. A pearl of precum formed at his cock slit. He peeled the foreskin all the way back.
Ick! God, Bruce! It's smegma. You haven't been washing.
Head cheese. Gives it flavor. You'll love it.
No, Bruce, no!
Enough arguing. Suck my dick, faggot.
Bruce's hand caught the back of Alan's neck.
No, Bruce, no! How can you do this to me?
Yes, yes, come on. Join me. I need a buddy. Come on. I'm about to get it. Drink my cum. Swallow my straight cum, cocksucker.
Bruce drew Alan's head closer. Alan's eyes glazed over with fear.
We'll be together this way, Alan. We'll be buddies. Come on, take my wad.
Alan tried to pull back, but he could not take his eyes off the cock, Bruce's huge, hot, throbbing cock. He couldn't look away. Bruce's hand pulled Alan's neck.
No, Bruce, please don't make me.
Tears began forming in Alan's eyes.
I'm so lonely. Take it, and then we'll be friends. You'll be my brother-in-law. Come on, hurry. Don't you know how hard it is for straight Bruce to have friends? Eat me, faggot, eat me.
Bruce's balls clamped up close to the base of his cock. Alan couldn't pull away. His lover was still somewhere inside of straight Bruce. He couldn't help himself. He opened his mouth.
Bruce's cock aimed at his mouth, coming closer and closer. Bruce's balls began to jump.
How long has this been going on?
Mona shrieked as he stood at the open door in full drag. Alan looked up.
Oh, no! Bruce's cock pumped out its wad, 4-5 spurts, arcing into the air and splatting against the TV screen.
Nobody answered me when I knocked, Mona explained. So I didn't think anyone would mind if I let myself in.
Oh, God, it's wasted. You wasted my wad, you little cocksucker.
Help! Mona, get me out of here. Run, Alan, run! The Volvo's downstairs. I left the motor running.
Alan broke free and ran toward Mona and the door.
No, come back! Come back! I can get it up again. It will only take a second. Oh, gee, if only I weren't so drunk.
Bruce staggered to his feet, pulling frantically at his limp cock.
"Ta-ta, Bruce!" Mona waved. "Sorry, we have to run. I guess you're so drunk that you won't remember this in the morning, will you?"
As the Volvo pulled away from the curb, Alan noticed that his trousers were still unzipped. He zipped them. "Thank goodness you came by when you did, Mona. He was about to... There, there, I know. The professor is one of my afternoon callers. He told me all about it. You just have to stay away from here for a few more weeks. Bruce has bought a house in the suburbs. By the time he moves, we think the transformation will be complete."
"You mean..."
"Yes. He'll be at Kinsey Zero. He won't even want to try something like that again."
Caught in the Volvo, a fly buzzed past Alan's cheek. Alan began to sob softly.
Indio by Al Lujan. From Best American Erotica, 1995. Read by Myron Willis.
"Don't roll your eyes at me. I was just trying to tell you that I thought perhaps, maybe, I was possibly starting to fall in love with you, pinchy coward. You don't know me, or my people. I was 10 the first time I told a man that I thought, perhaps, maybe, I was possibly starting to fall in love with him. Indio was his name. He was in Big Hazard, a gang at my barrio in East Los Angeles. He was my sister's old man. She stole him from a chola named La Payasa. He was a fine white cholo. He had the first blue eyes I'd ever looked into that weren't on television. The only blue eyes in my barrio. Hair like dawn's golden blaze. Slicked back. Tres flores pomade. Crew tattoos down his veiny forearms. Big Hazard. Done in juvenile hall. All those fine cholos did juvie. His teeth looked like those bright white chiclets they sell at the border. They sparkled when he smiled, which was hardly ever. They crowned his fuzzy goatee. Red bandana, white tee, khakis, Converse, always. Motherfucking fine white cholo. My sister and I would stay up late talking, listening to 45s and making up dances. I remember I made up this dance to I'm Your Puppet. It was a cross between these Balinese dancers I'd seen on a film at school and that cholo posturing that still turns me on. It never really caught on. Not with the cholos. Not with the Balinese. Not even with those fucking dorks on American Bandstand. My sister practiced on me what she would say to Indio later. And showed me how they kissed, tongue and all, on her life-sized Pink Panther stuffed toy. Bumping and rolling, all motion. I took notes. And like that song said, I beat her to the punch. He was waiting for her after school by the flood control building off Soto Street by my house. My sister, that skag... She was always in detention at Santa Teresita Catholic School for Girls. Girls tripping down that road to cholahood. Held by 10th grade, she was already teasing her hair, reeking of Aquanet. She plucked out all her eyebrows and drew them back even higher than La Payasa. And La Payasa was chola controla. So I hung out with him between buildings, listening to oldies on his portable 8-track. He pulls out this wrinkled pinner, lights it. ¿Quieres? Compra. Just kidding, Holmes. Toma. I took the joint, put it to my mouth and took a puff. I really didn't inhale. I mean, I was only 10. I just held it in my mouth. Then it all spilled out. I told him that I thought perhaps maybe I was possibly starting to fall in love with him. And threw in that I thought he was the toughest and cutest cholo in Big Hazard, even if he was a white boy. Those were my sister's words, really. I told you I took notes. He started laughing. And that hurt. It hurt worse than, whoosh, El Chicote, The electrical cord used to discipline my brother and I when we were acting like maniacos. So he laughed, for a while, and stopped and asked, "You really think so, Holmes?" "Claro que sí," I squeaked back. He leaned over and put his mouth on mine. I reached up, put my hands on his face, and pulled him into me, like I'd seen my sister and the Pink Panther do. He put his tongue in my mouth, filled it. I had to put my hands on his waist because I felt drunk, drunk. He pulled open his Pendleton, folded it, placed it down. He took my hand and guided it around his torso. I felt his hard stomach, his hard chest. I even felt the hair under his arms, of which I had none. He led my hand down to the front of his khakis, and there, with my trembling hand, I felt my first hard dick, also which I had none of, yet. With his free hand, he pulled my head down. A sudden yank at my hair, and I was floored. My sister was over me, scratching my face with her knee in my gut. Nearby, my mother, crying, looking skyward, "Por qué, Jesus, por qué?" Blood ran down my face and spotted the sidewalk like black cherry stars. Blood, the color of my birthstone. Through my tears, I could see my brother running toward India with a switchblade in his hand. This was, of course, before the pop of a pistol was such a familiar sound in the barrio. Shit. I would have been the first widowed, preteen, gringo, boyfriend-stealing, queer bastard in East Los Angeles. Maybe not. Indio took off up Soto Street. My brother right behind him, dodging fat women with fat children. And just vanished. My family moved to Southgate. My sister ran away from home. My brother kicked my ass just about every day. Puto, pinche maricón, fucking sissy became my new nicknames. My abuelita, who used to call me mijo, my son, now referred to me as jodito, little fag. This was my grandmother. But worse than all of that shit, much worse, I never got to see Indio, that fine white cholo, again. So the next time I try to tell you that I thought, perhaps, maybe, I was possibly starting to fall in love with you, don't roll your eyes at me, man. Just look deep into mine. Then look over your shoulder.
The Queen of Exit 17 by Ernie Conrick from Best American Erotica 2000. Read by Stefan Rudnicki.
The nicest man I've ever seen was the Queen of Exit 17. If you are driving south on Route 95, past the Mass Pike and the radio towers of Needham Heights, often called the antenna farm during morning traffic reports, you will see a blue sign for a rest stop or service area near Exit 17 in Westwood. At first glance, there is not much going on at Exit 17. There are no gas stations or restaurants or public facilities there, just a half acre of asphalt and three telephone booths. To a certain type of man, however, the Exit 17 rest stop offers something very desirable, a dark corner. The dark corner is down at the far end of the parking area toward the access ramp. It is overhung by high, thick trees, and the land there slopes downward into an even gloomier alcove that, in the dark of night, has blackness enough to cover up the most clandestine of acts. Exit 17 is directly across the highway from the Massachusetts Correctional Facility, which the Commonwealth had the vision to build on the median strip of an interstate highway. This utilizes unused land, avoids the not-in-my-backyard mentality of nearby residents, and provides an additional barrier to escaping prisoners, who would not only have to scale the walls, but also avoid the careening vehicles of maniacal Boston drivers. The floodlights that blaze incessantly from the prison reveal a ziggurat-like structure that, like some ancient Sodom, rises in slabs of concrete and barbed wire atop chain-link fences. I know about Exit 17 because I seek out dark corners. I have visited enough of them, in fact, to be a connoisseur. I could write a guidebook of dark corners, with ratings for forlornness and isolation. Exit 17 is my unequaled favorite because it is wholly stark and neglected. Nobody would stop at Exit 17 for very long unless they were exhausted, drunk, or loved dark corners like me. As you may have guessed, I go there for sex. I am a type of sexual being that has no accurate name. You can call me gay, queer, a sex addict, or any number of other names, and you still have not hit the nail on the head. I'm not quite gay, although, as you have also probably guessed, all sex at places like Exit 17 is between men. I love my wife with all my heart. I make love to her often and enthusiastically, and I'm not faking it. The closest you can come is to say that I have an obsession with anonymous intimacy. I find a strange inebriation in showing an utter stranger the most private side of myself. There is something pure and real in a random encounter between strangers. Perhaps it is because I think that talking ruins sex. In my opinion, the less talking the better. There should be only a naked singularity of genitals, cum, groans, grasping and subtle signals. To be an animal for a few moments in a dark corner, unobserved by the world. That is what I live for. Can you understand? Imagine pulling off the highway in the middle of the night. Even the blinking of your turn signal may serve as a signal to others like you. Turn slowly off the highway and drive through the parking lot. Maybe there is a car or two already in the dark corner with taillights that glint in the glare of your headlights like the eyes of a raccoon. Kill the lights and glide, dark and silent, into the gloom. There is a car next to you and a silhouette in its front seat. Shadows dance as cars pass by on the road. The silhouette shifts so that you are now two silhouettes face to face. You both freeze and wait, shuffling nervously and scanning your eyes in all directions. Maybe you are ready, but you must wait because now there is another car pulling off the highway. It parks between you with its lights on, radio blaring. A drunken man stumbles out, oblivious to what he is interrupting, and stumbles forward into the edges of the wood. As the tinkle of his piss fills the still void between cars, you steal a nervous glance at the silhouette. You smile, and he smiles back. You can't see him do it, nor he you. But you know it happens, because even here, in the dark corner of Exit 17, there is xenophobia, hatred of the foreigner. The man relieves himself, weaves back to his front seat, fishes in his jeans for his keys for what seems like an eternity, searches for the ignition for another eon, adjusts the radio for a millennium, and then, like a glacier in summer, his car recedes and pulls back onto the highway where he belongs. Now you and the silhouette begin to stir again. Two strangers in two cars in the dark corner of Exit 17. One stranger leaves his car and stretches as if exhausted, the last of his acting. Now he steps into the woods, pushes his pelvis forward, pissing or stroking. His shadow shifts. He is looking over his shoulder. With one last check in the rearview mirror for the square headlights of the highway patrol, you are out of your car and into the shadows. That is what it is like for me to visit Exit 17 late at night. Make what judgment you like. This isn't a confession. It all began as a drunken lark after Thanksgiving dinner one year. Soon I visited regularly and with enthusiasm. Now, as you can imagine, everybody looks pretty much the same in the pitch black. Even if I had seen them walking down the street, I could not recognize anybody with whom I had tangled at exit 17. Honestly, I am not entirely sure if I am having sex with many different partners or just a small group over and over again. Cars, however, are easier to recognize under such circumstances, and I begin to notice that I was often finding myself parked next to an Oldsmobile Achiever. There were several other things that I began to recognize about this particular visitor to Exit 17. For one thing, he always wore some sort of vanilla cologne that I liked instantly. For another, he was young, probably early 20s, and thin to the point of bony. Other than that, I could not tell much about him. He was always quiet and quick, but not nervous. I always felt that I had hit the jackpot if I found the olds in that dark corner. I hit the jackpot often. Neither of us was there in that dark corner to make friends, and we both tried to avoid recognizing each other. However, by the fourth or fifth encounter, I felt that introductions were inevitable. I was leaning against the tree with my back to the highway waiting for him. The young man, knowing that I was waiting, lingered in his car, playing with the radio and dragging hurriedly on a camel. Over my shoulder I could see the green glow of the dashboard and the pale orange glow of the cigarette illuminating the jawline of his angular face. I leaned my head back and inhaled sharply while rolling my head back and forth over grooves in the tree bark. At last I heard the door of his car close softly and the dry crackle of leaves and pine needles beneath his feet. I felt his hand on my biceps and covered it with my own. He slid his lithe body up against me and stroked my chest with long, elegant fingers, head resting on my shoulder. As the tips of his fingers circled slowly around my nipples, I ran my hands along his side and followed the tight denim of his jeans from his lower back to his upper thigh. Now his hands fell lower, and with a touch so light as to be undetectable at first, he stroked me through my own jeans, finding the spot directly behind the ridge of the head. With a finger as light as an angel's tongue, he tickled me so that my back arched and my shoulders ground against the trunk of the tree. I tried to help him unfasten my belt buckle, but he pushed my hand away, clasping my palm between his thin fingers. He undid it himself. Now I was in the grasp of his cold hand, as delicate as icicles. I grabbed at him roughly and placed his weight against me. He stepped away, however, and considered me with a gaze that I could not see but imagined held patience, smugness, and perhaps a touch of cruelty. Then I watched as his shadow sank slowly and his icicle fingers guided me gingerly into his hot throat. With both hands resting on my thighs, his head rocked back and forth. My arms, too polite to hold him firmly to the ground, curled backward around the tree trunk as if I were a Salem warlock tied to the post. As we parted, I asked, "What's your name?" I could hear him exhale quickly in what might have been a laugh. He leaned in close and looked up at me. "I," he declared, "am the queen of Exit 17. He walked away, glancing backward. His face might have held any expression. Cruising season usually ends by mid-October, when all the lonely men are driven inside by the cold. Until spring, they are trapped inside with their wives, who, month by month, loom larger and larger. By February, their wives are monstrous. So large, in fact, that their heads must bend so as not to go through the ceiling. These poor men can have no secrets until the spring, when the windows open and they escape, gasping, onto the front lawn. This year, I could not bear the reality of the coming winter. I refused to wear sweaters. I didn't change from a summer weight suit after Labor Day, and I drove home from work without my headlights on. I also kept visiting Exit 17. It didn't help. The days grew shorter and colder. The leaves turned melancholy orange and yellow. Pumpkins fell from heaven and landed on every doorstep, and front doors sprouted ears of Indian corn. The slanting light of autumn somehow makes every object look large, adding deep, cold shadows to them. The weather didn't stop the Queen of Exit 17 from his appointed rounds either. As October drew near its end, the Queen and I, and possibly a grizzled truck driver or two, were the only shadows left in the dark corner of Exit 17. And counters, after my brief introduction, again lapsed into silence and became more awkward as the two of us, fingers numb from the chill air, fumbled with down coats, three layers of shirts and long underwear. Across the highway, the trees, which had lost all but a few random tufts of leaves, fully revealed the prison house. The floodlights blared in electric blue intensity, catching violet auras in the empty air. These lights, now shining unhindered from behind the bare trees, revealed the rows of barbed wire coiled on the tops of the chain-link fences, the spikes catching the light on dull points of metal, and giving the illusion of jagged Christmas tinsel discarded by giants. By early November, there were only a couple of leaves on the trees, some changing weather pattern. A scrambling of L's and H's on the meteorologist's map had given New England Arctic air. I was drinking hard at the Irish Embassy. A forgotten acquaintance appeared and bought me a shot of Goldschlager. German liqueurs are dangerous. They taste like cough medicine, but they hide a powerful spirit, a Teutonic spirit, a berserk Viking spirit, a cold and blonde beast. You always get a little crazy after a shot of Goldschlager, and that night I had four. My acquaintance went on about other acquaintances more forgotten than himself, and alluded to riotous drunks that he wrongly assumed I had been present at. I could not follow him and became sullen. He eventually turned in his chair and introduced himself to a sweet girl named Bridget. Then a chubby little blonde walked in and smiled at me. The corners of my mouth twitched in involuntary response, my eyes following her to the nearby bar stool where she parked herself. Through the gloom, she smiled again and played with her hair that was intermittently illuminated by passing headlights in the wet, chill night. This is how it starts, with a sidelong glance from an overfed girl. If I tried, I knew I could have her. With the right lines, the right lies, the right parts played, I could calm myself between her legs. Yes, I could. But the price is too high. I took another shot and turned away. I knew where I would end up that night. I arrived about 1 o'clock, drunk. The prison floodlights reflected off the full heavy clouds, grumbling with thunder. The lot was empty, except for the Queen. By now I could recognize his car in the pitch black. Gliding up next to him, I turned on the interior light and pretended to play with my hair in the rearview mirror. The Queen turned on his lights and did the same. It was all a good joke. Simultaneously, we stepped from our cars into the dark and grabbed each other awkwardly. I felt him shiver through his jacket. "Freezing out," he said. Even drunk, I sensed that the cold had ruined the mood for him. "Sure is," I agreed. The Queen leaned back against the tree and with a tilt of his head glanced at the sky. Not many leaves on the trees. He was right again. The dark corner was not so dark that night. The lights of the highway and the prison were reflecting off of the storm clouds and down through the trees, bare but for a pair of wet oak leaves. In the gloom, his face was striking. His nose was sharp, as was his chin. His hair, hanging down in front of his eyes in greasy spikes, accentuated the angularity of his features. "You're beautiful," I said, pushing myself against him. "You're drunk," he laughed, then smiled. A bit, I agreed. The sky rumbled and the wind suddenly shifted from chilling to warm and wet. It felt like rain. Do you have a place? He asked. No. Pause. Do you? He shook his head. It would've, could've, should've stopped right there. But the Goldschlager surged in my blood and spoke for me. Let's get a hotel room. I'll pay. He nodded in silent agreement. Then I noticed that he checked his watch. Hotels are very impersonal places for very personal encounters. Some women swear by sex in cheap hotels. I never understood this until that night. It's hard to say exactly what it is about the sanitized, deodorized interior of a Super 8 room that can make a sexual encounter so special. For one thing, it makes you feel like a seedy, sleazy mook on a lonely stretch of nowhere street, streets lined with Kmarts and countless Exxon filling stations. For another, there is supreme solitude. When you are safely locked in room 242 and registered under a name that you stole from the boy who sat next to you in fourth grade, you cannot be found. You are as alone as the guru on the Himalayan mountaintop. There is nothing but you and your lover in a sanitized nowhere. The few moments in that room, as the young man and I quietly disrobed and wrestled with the thermostat, was the only time I ever saw him in the light. I have difficulty connecting the shadow that I would see at exit 17 with the person who stood before me in the cold glow of the bathroom lights. I must say that imagination had been kind to the queen of exit 17. My mind had extrapolated on the unknown features of the queen, making him taller and thinner than he really was. His face, unblemished in the shadows and imagined as tan and smooth, was in actuality pale and scarred. The look of innocence I had seen in the dark was, in the light, an expression of jaded resignation. Eyes that had caught the hard glare of the prison, turning it into soft blue spark, in the light, were dull and glossed. It may have been the same for him to now see me. Both of us wordlessly agreed to quickly shut off the lights before completely undressing. With the lights out, the illusion revived. Always restricted in movement in an outside cruising spot, I enjoyed the free range of motion that we now had. We could lie flat, kneel, get on all fours, and stick our feet in the air. Most enjoyable was the sensation of complete nudity. Whatever he looked like, the queen had beautiful feet. The sex started and stopped in fits and waves. After the initial rapture, we both expected to dress and leave. He sat on the edge of the bed, his hand sweeping the sheets for his shirt, but I encompassed him from behind and ran my hands over his smooth chest, and we were at it again. We traded tongues over his bare shoulder, his thin hand stroking my cheek. I kissed his neck and his nape, all the while caressing his chest. He touched himself between his legs, running his palm over his thick, uncut cock. Suddenly, standing, with his hands on his hips as if to scold, he presented his cock to me. Sitting on the edge of the bed, I swallowed him slowly and sucked the viscous, salty drop that hung on the tip. I swirled my tongue around the head, then plunged his entire cock deep into my throat, my lips touching the downy hair beneath his stomach. During the next pause, I felt a strong and feverish sense of failure to my wife. "I've made a mistake," I began, but he quieted me with a shh, as gentle as water from a stream. I lay down again, his mouth on mine. I woke with a start the next morning. The queen was already dressed, fumbling on the floor for his wristwatch. He looked at me, but I turned my eyes toward the far wall and locked them there. "Bye," he said, still looking at me.
but I will never know the expression. I smiled at the wall, and he turned to go, quietly shutting the door. The stillness in the room was unbearable, so despite my pounding head, I dressed. Looking about the room, I saw that we had left no mark that the chambermaid would not wash away. That thought haunted me. For a few minutes I wandered around the room, sat on the corner of the bed, and lifted the burlap curtain. It was snowing outside. The whole world was covered in white, except for the tire tracks of the street, which were wet and black. A chill seeped through the window of the Super 8, and I sniffled. In the drawer next to the cum-stained bed was Gideon's Bible. There in Gideon's was chapter 21 of Samuel 1, where Jonathan kisses David in the field. Just a few pages away, in the first pages of Samuel 2, David cries for Jonathan. It is a speech that inflames many clerics who, on cold winter days, sit inside, quietly reading their Bibles.
Pre-Dahmer, by Trac Vu, from Best American Erotica, 1995. Read by Myron Willis.
The first time I ever chewed gum, it was in Saigon, after the communists took over. Food was scarce. We were constantly hungry. My brother's friend's aunt abroad sent his family a shipment that contained a pack of spearmint, strawberry flavor, or something sweet like that. When my brother got back with the loot, it was late at night. A couple of hours after dinner, which we had stretched to no end. 5 people had shared an omelette made with 2 eggs and 19 tomatoes. When I started chewing on the spearmint, sugar released on my tongue. I wanted to swallow the gum right then and there, eat it like I would a piece of meat. But I knew that I couldn't. That gum was for chewing, that eventually I'd have to spit it back out in one piece. That's what it was like sucking a guy for the first time.
The Maltese Dildo, by Adam McCabe, from Best American Erotica, 2000. Read by Stephen Hoy.
My latest client still hadn't told me his name. He sat upright in the Chippendale facing me, his legs spread against the chair arm so I had a front row seat for the action. Wearing nothing but a long silk robe, he played with his asshole during our interview, watching me for a reaction. His hole, puckered and red, looked resigned to this treatment. He slid 2 fingers back and forth inside of himself as he waited for my reply. "Well, Mr. McCabe," he said, not stopping his rhythm. "I'm not sure I can help. I usually look for things of value. You can buy a dildo at any sex shop." He stopped and sat up, his dick part of the folds of the robe, throbbing in the surrounds of silk. "It's not any dildo. It's invaluable. Why? Lose your virginity on it?" He smiled languidly. "No. That might make it an antique, but hardly worth the effort. This dildo has a jewel-encrusted handle, rubies and sapphires along the outside, and emeralds near the base. My family brought it from Malta generations ago." I barked out a laugh, which disappeared into the heavy drapes of the darkened drawing room. "You mean to tell me that you shove precious gems up your ass? I was a top man all the way. How could anyone want to have another man up his ass?" He pulled the robe around him so that his hard-on disappeared from view. Maybe I'd overstepped my boundaries. "If you want to phrase it like that, yes. Will you take the case?" I nodded, $400 a day, plus expenses. He leaned back again in the chair and ran a finger down between his balls to explore his hole again. The poor thing never got any rest. Very well. Let me tell you the story. The facts will do. Stories are for children. Three fingers went up his hole to the second knuckle. He seemed to be missing his dildo quite a bit these days. I could see that a butt plug wouldn't be enough for this guy. He sighed, whether from exasperation or lust, I couldn't tell. As you wish, the facts. 3 days ago, I hosted an orgy here at my home. One of the guests stole the dildo at that function. So someone you know did it? Why don't you just ask for it back? Some people had more money than sense. Not that easy. My friend Albert Gutman set up the event. My house, his party, his friends. Does Gutman keep a guest list? His fingers started a rhythm that barely left him energy to speak. If I had a name or a better description, I would appeal to him directly. You see, all I know is that this particular thief is well endowed. 11 inches, at least. I heard people refer to him as the Fat Man, but that's the only name I know for him. Albert might know him, but it's a rather embarrassing situation. So how do you know he's the thief? Could have been anyone at the party. His cock pulsed like a metronome in time to the movement of his fingers. Pre-cum flowed off the head of his dick and into the folds of his robe. We were becoming acquainted, this big man and I. When I came, I closed my eyes to savor the moment. I opened my eyes to find that he and the dildo were gone. Simple as that. You got Gutman's number? Sounds like the place to start. I watched him, feeling my own cock press against the leg of my pants. His act was reminding me how long I'd been celibate. He pointed to a small marble table. Better than that. On the table is an invitation to Albert's next party. It's tonight. Albert has assured me that the guest list is the same, except you'll be going in my stead. As he finished his words, he came. Milky white liquid shot out of him and ran down his shaft in torrents, disappearing into the robe. I took a deep breath. Most cases didn't get me this horny. I'd be ready for tonight, if I could wait that long. Fine, I'll be there. But what makes you think this mystery man will be interested in me? Mr. McCabe, trust me, he will. Just bring me back the dildo. As promised, I left with an invitation to a small soiree that evening. Its engraved lettering and thick vellum envelope revealed no sign of illicit sex. The whole scene stank of money, though. The rent on the office was due next week. I didn't have a lot of choice in how the bills got paid at this point. Never having been to a fuckfest, I wasn't sure how to dress. Intimate scenes with a single partner were my forte. I couldn't get that interview out of my mind as I threw on a sports coat with my jeans and white Tommy shirt. No use getting too spiffed up since the clothes would be doffed inside the door. I arrived at 8 per the invitation. I'd hoped for a chance to scout the place before most of the others got there, but the house was packed. House? Hell. It was a mansion. First time I'd ever seen a crowd of punctual gay men. A valet led me into a drawing room where 5 men stood stripping. I followed along, trying to look like I knew the score. No one looked familiar, and none of their dicks matched my client's description. I undressed in a hurry. The valet placed my clothes into a private locker and gave me the key attached to a wrist strap. The hallway was packed with men looking to score. I had work to do. The first floor was a series of showrooms, each space filled with antiques and mahogany furniture. I wasn't sure how the old masters would have felt about this place. I walked around, trying to ignore the variety of dicks in my path. None came close to the description of the Fat Man's. A winding marble staircase led to the second level, and I began a search of the upstairs bedrooms. Plenty of action, but no 11-inch dicks. I decided to take a piss. Even with the mass nudity, I wanted a little privacy and shut the bathroom door behind me. Someone entered while I was going and watched from the doorway. When I looked up, I knew I'd found my prey. Even at half-mast, his cock was the biggest I'd ever seen. Thick, with the ropey veins that meant plenty of blood to the organ. He held up a dildo and smiled. Interested in some fun? The toy was nearly as big as he was, probably 10 inches, thick and the color of night. I couldn't make out the handle, so I wasn't positive that this was my client's dildo. I shook the last drops and stepped toward him. I'm always up for some fun. He smiled and pulled the door shut. His dick grew, almost bridging the gap between us. I didn't know what we could do with a cock that size. He held up the dildo, and the light sparkled off the handle. I'd found what I'd come here for. Bend over. The fat man pulled a rubber and some lube out of the medicine cabinet. With one hand, he protected the end of the toy and made the device slick to the touch. I smiled. I'm not really into that. My own dick didn't look up to his standards. He matched my smile and tapped the dildo in his hand. Everyone says that the first time. Trust me. He moved closer to me, blocking my exit. The tile wall cooled my back as I looked for a way to escape, but I didn't see any. Not if I wanted to do my job. I didn't have what I came here for yet. I let a finger slide up inside me as his monster dick rubbed against my stomach. He lubed my abs with his juices. The sensation and heat of our cocks thrusting in time made me want to come now. A second finger entered me and the moment was lost. The pain was bearable, but made me twinge, imagining what he could do to me. The dildo slid down into his palm, and I felt the head of the toy penetrate me. I lost my erection as the sex toy filled my ass. I'd never been fucked before, and a mingling of excitement and fear swept over me, wanting the sensation and dreading the pain. He turned me to face the wall and slid an arm around my waist to pull my ass out. I was almost bent at the waist by this point as the dildo traveled inside me. I could feel it push against my pucker. He rested a second and moved it inside me. My sphincter protested and then gave in. The dildo gained entrance and filled me. I moaned so loud that the fat man laughed. You're getting into this fast, aren't you? Maybe it's time for the real thing. My knees nearly buckled as I thought of his huge dick penetrating me. I didn't know if I could handle all of it and remain conscious. 400 a day didn't begin to cover this. He gave the dildo a few more thrusts in me. I imagined the jewels scratching my ass. The dildo clattered to the floor, and I pushed it with my foot under a towel near the wall. He didn't seem to notice as he made preparations with lube and another rubber. Even facing the wall, I could smell his sweat as he approached me again. Ready for ecstasy? I grunted, trying to prepare. Nothing could have helped. The first push made my eyes roll up in my head. The pain filled every cell and yet felt delicate in a way I'd never known. His arms slid around me to keep me standing as he started to thrust. The oversized biceps held me in place and I began to lick one. When he was sure I wasn't going to fall to a pile on the ground, his hand slipped down to my crotch and began to massage my limp dick. All my attention was on the feelings in my sphincter. I could feel the ripping in my ass as he explored. I leaned back against him and felt the rough pressure of hair against my back. He nibbled on my neck while he squeezed my dick slowly in one hand. I wanted him to come so this moment could be over, but he had just gotten started. His balls slapped against my ass, and he pushed me up against the wall again. I couldn't move as the heat of his dick filled me. I expected my stomach to explode like the scene from Aliens at any moment. He began to bite my back and shoulders as he massaged my dick. I started to feel the familiar stirrings as he clamped down on my cock and stretched it to full length. "You'd be good as a top man, too, wouldn't you?" he whispered the words in my ear as he pulled on my lobe with his teeth. Through clenched teeth, I said, "I've done that before." A savage thrust made me whimper. "I'll bet you have." The words released him, and his balls contracted as he shot his load inside me. The sensation was unlike any I'd had. He continued to work me, and I shot my wad against the bathroom wallpaper. I noticed a young guy lying on the floor by the towel and dildo, letting my cum splash his upper body. I hadn't realized that anyone else had entered the room, but three guys were jacking off to the scene we provided. The fat man pulled out and threw the rubber into the toilet. I staggered out of the room, still feeling his dick inside me, gripping the towel and dildo to ensure that the experience was worth it. The next day, I returned to my client's home, carting his prized possession. A butler led me into the study where my client sat in a robe with the hood pulled over his face. I laid the dildo on the table between us and chose to stand. "Here's what you wanted, and here's my bill." The hood nodded. "Have you heard any complaints from Gutman? Any noise from the fat man?" I leaned up against the back of the chair and watched him. He shook the silk cloth covering. A whisper said, "The fat man had nothing but compliments for your performance. Said you were a natural." I straightened up and stared at the cloaked figure. If he knew these people, why had he hired me? What was going on here? I limped across to his chair and pulled back the hood. My ex-lover's face came into view. "What the hell?" I stepped back and bumped my ass against the table. Pain shot through me. "Hello, JJ. Have a nice time last night? Thought you needed a little loosening up, so to speak." He smiled at me. "This was all just a revenge plot?" He nodded. "Not bad, huh? Now I think we're even." He stood up and walked out of the room. I was left to limp back to my car and gingerly make my way home.
Apuja to Ganesha by Simon Shepherd, from Best American Erotica, 1997. Read by Myron Willis.
The end of the grimy corridor, right next to the unspeakable toilet. I wrestled open the heavy sliding door. Most compartments on these old railway cars accommodated 6 seated, 4 sleeping. But the grotesquely misspelled reservation list placed me in a coupe, a 2-passenger compartment. The single bench seat was already occupied by a man in his 40s, prosperously overweight, in the manner of the Indian middle classes. He sat cross-legged, waving a stick of burning incense, chanting softly to himself. As I slid the door shut, he opened his eyes and smiled. "I've been making a puja to Ganesha." Praying, that is, to the elephant-headed son of Lord Shiva, supreme god of destruction and recreation. Shiva thought his son was screwing his wife Parvati and cut off Ganesha's head. Repentant, Shiva swore to restore his son with the head of the next creature he saw. An elephant walked by, and the great remover of obstacles took on his present form. A better story, surely, than the tale of the virgin birth. The Purva Express started with a lurch. I wiped the dirt from the gray plastic seat cover and sat down. Outside the filthy window, the station platform went by, impoverished families squatting by cloth-wrapped bundles of everything they owned. 2 handsome soldiers asleep on a bench, one's head on the other's shoulder. An old man cooking his dinner over a kerosene stove. tea seller's cries of chai, chai receded into the distance as the train left the wretched hutments on the edge of town. I resisted my compartment mate's attempts at conversation. "From which country are you coming?" and watched Village India go by. The sway of the train and clacking of the tracks. The vastnesses of Uttar Pradesh. In clay-red fields, farmers guiding buffalo-drawn plows finished the day's work. Egrets flew into the evening sky. Peasants, dhotis drawn up above their waists, squatted by the tracks to take a dump. A month after landing in Bombay, I was more confused than ever by these juxtapositions of loveliness and squalor. India, land of the impossible, the unspeakable, the unbearable. When Chaz was dying, I resolved to make this trip, a journey we'd long dreamed of. We'd been planning the itinerary when the first lesions had appeared. Losing Chaz had left an emptiness in me, an emptiness I thought could never be filled. Usually, Westerners who end up in India are on a spiritual quest of one sort or another, looking for something to fill a void in their lives. And like every Westerner, I'd gotten more than I'd bargained for. My expectations confounded at every turn. Nothing I'd studied about Hinduism back at Berkeley could have prepared me for India's tumultuous assault, its filth, its endless petty annoyances. Reading Ramakrishna in the comfort of a dorm room is nothing like watching peasant women smear clarified butter over a stone lingam, the stylized dick that symbolizes Shiva, Lord of Death. "Veg or non-veg, sir?" My reveries were interrupted by the porter delivering dinner. Indian Railway's vegetarian dinners were nothing special, but the scrawny chicken legs provided for carnivores were even worse. "Veg." The porter, stunningly good-looking, with sparkling dark eyes, smiled broadly as he handed me the tray. I could have taken this as a mild flirtation if I chose to. I chose to. As he left the compartment, his thin, stained trousers rode up the crack of his ass. My seatmate and I unwrapped the foil from our metal trays. I said a silent prayer that the meal would leave my bowels in peace, and dug into searingly spicy vegetarian cutlets, watery yogurt, and a warm bottle of Campa Cola. Ashok's transistor radio provided dinner music, filmy songs from Bombay movies. Women sang with a maddening little girl whine as though they'd been inhaling helium. Small talk over the cutlets revealed that Ashok was a businessman from Calcutta who had been in Delhi for the funeral of his aunt. "She was wishing to die in Varanasi, but it was not to be," he said in the melodic rhythms of Indian English. "As you may know, old chap, Varanasi is the city of Shiva, the place where all Hindus are wishing to breathe their last." He popped an after-dinner pan, a leaf-wrapped packet of betel nut, into his mouth and started to chew. Now he was headed home to his wife and two sons, whom he loved immoderately. "But you must tell me all about America. A cousin of mine now is living in San Jose." As he spoke, he laid a pudgy hand on my knee. I'd become semi-accustomed to the subcontinent's different standards of personal space, i.e., the way people were always getting in my face. But Ashok's hand, with its showy gold rings, was not just lying there. As he spoke, it slowly but inexorably crept up my thigh. He stared down at my crotch. I'm not one of those guys whose third world vacations include fucking exotic brown-skinned boys. That sort of behavior always smacked of sexual imperialism to me. And let's face it, my compartment mate, with his greasy hair and quivering jowls, was nobody's ideal sex object. Still, a come-on is a come-on, and I hadn't had sex since Chaz died. Despite my better judgment, my dick was starting to swell. Ashok smiled lewdly, fussy black mustache curling above teeth red stained from beetle. There was a knock at the compartment door. I started to draw back, but Ashok kept his hand firmly mid-thigh. It was the gorgeous young porter. "Finish?" he asked with an insinuating grin, then vanished with our trays and bottles. Nice ass. Exotic brown-skinned boy. And would my new friend from America perhaps be